We would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land where this case takes place, the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung and Bunurong people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging. We also acknowledge that this land was never ceded, always was, always will be Aboriginal land.
Mother Fluffers, I'm Jimmy.
And I'm Alice.
And this is the Signal 2 podcast. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Hello.
How you doing? Somebody guess the song.
Why don't you leave yet? Well, I don't know.
Wow.
That was not enough quick thinking.
No, that was a crash and burn.
Pew, pew, pew.
But somebody guessed it after what we had planned
to be
for many months.
Months.
Like, yeah, to be many months' work. Somebody guessed it after like, what, two episodes? So if you're not sure what we're talking about, the last couple of episodes we've been giving away clues to guess where did whoop whoop mother fluffers came from. Obviously it used to be like whoop whoop motherfuckers, and yeah, somebody guessed it. Somebody guessed it. Jeanette, amazing work. That's amazing.
Cannot even.
Apparently I'd said it or I'd give, you know, mentioned
it. Our listeners are so observant.
100%. I was like, you have better memory and listening skills than I do.
I know. We're like little baby children.
That's right. So, yeah, if you don't know what we're talking about, it's guessing where it came from. And it was indeed the band Pussifer. The song was Conditions of My Parole.
That's your bass player. You can get last or whatever it is.
Adolf Spritzer. Freddie Mercury, motherfucker.
Unless you're I don't know how to get in a car. I've been in a car before.
That's a can of worms.
You can't put the monkeys back in.
Anyway, if you don't know what we're talking about, it is from this video clip. It's, the lead singer of Tool. He's got, another side band called Pussifer. It's just hilarious. And
good,
I remember.
Good 3 minutes 45 and you'll see bit of an intro to the song. And then
that's it. He dresses up as like an army guy, major douche, and anyway, it's where it came from. Many nights ago when the podcast first started, I was listening to it, having a whiskey or two, and just thought it was funny, and was like, oh, that could be our thing,
because
like,
we were looking for a catchphrase.
That's right. Whoop whoop. Anyway, that's been happening. How are you going?
Yeah, a bit. Bit flat.
Mm.
Flat like a little shitty pancake. Like those terrible ones, not the fluffy ones.
Not like the New York pancakes.
Yeah.
Oh, that was so good.
Just a little bit.
Yeah. It's a time of the year. Everybody's like getting back at work and starting again. And I feel like, everybody's like, oh, really? All that? Now it's like back into it again. But yeah.
How are you though?
I'm doing all right. I'm that's exactly how I am. But I'm very excited. I've only got a few more weeks in my current work, so I'm sort of like, I got something to look forward to. So cannot complain. This is our 50th episode.
Ding, 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 ding.
Yay.
It's a long one.
I am very keen. I don't know if that's a word, but whatever. Very keen. Let's go with it.
It's a long one and inappropriate for a two-parter. So you're going to be here for a while, guys.
Okay, straddle in.
Half an hour later, I'm done. Can you imagine?
I could. It'd be something you do because you don't know your north from your south.
I don't.
So you don't probably don't
my
know.
Up from a down. This is a warning for this episode. Today's episode contains violence against children. If that's not your jam, see you whenever.
See you next day.
Bye. So today we're going to be talking about Mr. Krull.
No.
Initially labelled Mr. Cool for how cold and calculated his crimes were, but not only for that, for how meticulously he seemed to plan them and he never seemed to rush through his crimes. Now, obviously they changed that from Mr. Cool to Mr. Krull because probably shouldn't – they meant like, oh, he's like
cool
very
under
cool,
pressure.
Like cool under pressure, and then like, they probably thought, not a good day.
That's not where my mind went. I went straight to, oh, like he's a cool daddy-o.
Yeah,
like,
exactly. So I think that's why they changed it to Mr. Krull.
So what are we talking?
With the 80s.
80s, right. 80s. Okay, so cool's definitely something they use in like a good
like
80, term.
80s, 100%. Yeah.
By the way, I am drinking a whiskey.
It's
27-year-old Bunahavan. I absolutely love it. 50th episode, celebrate.
Not bad.
Yeah.
So he was described as a real-life boogeyman.
What does that even mean?
So, like, basically he was somebody who, like, the public was scared of. Like,
oh, you like know, the Bubba Yeager.
He's hiding in your house. He's hiding under your bed. Like, all that kind of stuff. Like, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Creepy. Now, it is believed that Mr. Krul had other offences before the crimes that we're going to talk about now, which I'll discuss later. But I'm telling you this now because it's important to note, this was something that I learned researching this case. There's a difference between a pedophile and a child sexual offender. So a pedophile only targets children, whilst a child sexual offender commits crimes against children but also adults.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So there is
that actually like a legit thing?
It's a legit thing, yeah.
I would have just thought it's a pedophile regardless. Like,
no, so it's they're a child sexual offender.
Child sexual offender.
Yeah.
And that's what he was.
Yes. Yes. So also there's going to be a few relevant asides during this case, but I'll tell you when they happen because like so much happens every now and then that you just got to push to the side for a second and explain a situation.
Okay, I understand.
So it's the 22nd of August 1987 in the Melbourne suburb of Lower Plenty. Now the identity of this victim has never been released. So we don't know anything about her other than that she was 11 years old.
Yeah.
So at 4 a.m. on the morning of the 22nd of August, a man removes a window pane in the lounge room of her house. The offender makes his way straight to the parents' bedroom, and here they're confronted with a terrifying sight. A man in a balaclava standing at the end of their bed with a knife and a gun. Now, as we know, we'll see photos, but that balaclava becomes iconic and it's the only image of Mr. Krul that's out there.
It is insanely creepy.
Insanely creepy.
It is. It's why this, I reckon this case lives in infamy apart from obviously, but just that image of that thing.
Now, the man immediately demands the parents get on the floor and lie on their stomachs. He ties the parents up and places surgical tape over their eyes and mouths. So he tells the parents all he wants is food, money, and clothes. This is a lie.
Yeah.
This is one of the many red herrings he'll throw into all of his crimes to sort of defer the police off. Is it a robbery? Did he just want food? So he's trying to make it seem like he's looking for something else when he's not in fact looking for that thing.
Right. So this sounds like somebody that is well-researched. Like, sorry, he knows how to get in quite easily. He knows the layout of the house.
Yes.
Well-prepared. So he does his research is what I was trying to say.
Absolutely.
And this doesn't seem like his first rodeo, 27th of August.
Completely agree.
22nd of August.
Completely agree. And one of the suspects at the end, who I 100% think it is, will understand why.
Okay.
So in the house is the parents' six-year-old son and their 11-year-old daughter. And it was the 11-year-old daughter that was always the target.
Okay.
In fact, like you said, it appeared he'd been watching the family for a long time. He was cold, calculated and intelligent and leaving nothing to chance. Now, the offender blindfolded the young boy, gagged him and tied him to the bed. It was now his turn to focus on the 11-year-old girl.
Sorry, was he at the boy's bed, the parents' bed, like in the bedroom?
In the bedroom, in the kid's bedroom.
In the kid's bedroom.
Yeah.
So did the boy share a bedroom with the sister or was it his
own? Yes,
yeah,
yes,
right.
Yes,
yeah. Okay.
Now he insisted that she thoroughly clean her teeth twice and then after that he sexually assaults her.
Oh, no.
Now during that time he had the radio playing to try and drown out any screams. Now, you would think he would leave pretty quickly after the assault, right?
Yeah.
In and out. He spends over 2 hours in the house before he leaves. He firstly makes the victim shower twice. He then makes himself a meal, searches the house, steals a few things he wants to, records, money, jewelry, and some clothing. And then, interestingly, while he's there, he makes a fake phone call, one in which he uses the distinctive word bozo, but also says that the person on the other end of the phone needs to move their children, otherwise they would be in danger.
What?
Now, we know this is a fake phone call for two reasons. Number one, cell phones not really a thing back then.
Yeah.
And number two, he'd cut the phone lines to the property before he entered.
Okay, so this is definitely somebody who knows what they're doing.
Yeah.
And it seems like he's like stealing a few items, once again, as like red herrings.
Yes.
Like this is a robbery gone wrong.
Yes.
Can I ask, when was DNA?
86. So like for this case, we can kind of ignore DNA, I think, because like it's in its infancy. Criminals probably didn't really know about it by that point.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And once he's done, he just leaves via the front door. Just walks out.
Jesus.
So although he had been careful and meticulous, there likely would have been a lot of cleanup involved, like just to make sure he, at that point it would be fingerprints and stuff like that, to make sure it didn't. So With that kept in mind, it may explain the escalation in the next victim. Now, I'm not going to talk about the police investigation in this section here because not much really happens. Because no clues, no leads, no forensics.
So there was nothing in this house?
Nothing. Now, the offender does seem to fade from memory for a period of time until he suddenly re-emerges on the 27th of December, 1989.
So 2 years
which is
later.
16 months. 16 months after his first attack in Lower Plenty. This time he strikes in the suburb of Ringwood. Now, I would describe, like, although these suburbs aren't super close, I imagine it's kind of like the size of the inner west.
Okay.
You know, some things are a bit further away, but we're all sort of in the general vicinity of each other.
Yeah. Oh, that's Lower Plenty, is it?
So Lower Plenty was the first. Ringwood is the case, the crime we're going to talk about now.
And the first one was 22nd of August, 1987? Yeah. That's not 16 months.
August, September, October, November, December, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16.
Yeah. Yeah, but then you got all of 88 and all of 89.
No, it's definitely 6 months. That's because you've got to do 87 to 88. Then it's just, oh.
Because in 88, it's 12 months. December 89, that's like another 11 and a half months.
Okay, all right. It's 88.
Okay. Oh, so it's 88. But
yeah. Okay. So my fat fingers, everybody.
No, that's fine. I'm glad
you did.
Okay.
Because so it's definitely 16 months.
Okay. It's 16 months.
It's definitely 16 months.
So it's 88.
Yeah.
Cool. In Ringwood.
In Ringwood.
Yeah.
So all evening, Mr. Krull sits outside this house, waiting for the lights to go out. Now, he'd already cut the phone lines, as with the previous crimes, ready for the attack. Now, he waits patiently as John Willis, the father, sat awake downstairs, unable to sleep. So he's completing a jigsaw puzzle to pass the time of his insomnia.
So wholesome.
Now, at around 5 a.m., he makes his way to bed. Now, this man waits until about 5:30 a.m., enough time to sort of say the father would have fallen asleep.
Yeah.
Now, upstairs sleeping is the father's four daughters, one of which is 10-year-old Sharon. Sharon is the cutest little girl you've ever seen in your entire life. She's got, like, literal pigtails that come from the side of her head like this with, like, different coloured hair elastics, that, like, little smile of a 10-year-old who's just innocent. Like, she's just this gorgeous little girl.
Yeah, completely innocent,
Exactly. Here's our first aside. This was not the first time the family and Sharon specifically had been in the news.
Mm.
6 months prior, a piece was done in the paper because Julie, her mother, had saved Sharon from a burning bed when a faulty electric blanket caught fire.
Oh, wow.
Now, everything was published in this, including the girls slept in bunk beds, they slept in the same room, all this kind of stuff was published in the newspaper.
Including addresses? It wouldn't have been hard to find out, I imagine. No, this kind of rings eerily similar to Graham Thorne.
Yeah.
You know how like all the information about the family was published in the newspaper, and that's how McDouche was able to find him and everything. So
very true.
So is this a similar kind of thing, do we think?
Yes. Okay. Yes. So he enters the house through a locked door. Now the way he enters this is like, it always reminds me of cartoons, but he must have known that the door would be locked but the key would still be in the door on the inside. So basically what he does is he slips a newspaper underneath the door, pushes like something through the lock so the key drops off inside. It drops onto the newspaper and he pulls the newspaper out. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do. I do. There must have been enough of a gap underneath the door for like
him to pull out
like the key without it slipping down.
Yeah.
So he's doing – that's insane amount of research for him to realize.
He's doing a lot of recces.
Yeah.
So first he enters the bedroom of Julie and John, the parents. He awakes them suddenly by turning on the light and pointing the gun and the knife at them. The man points the gun at John's head and basically says, don't do anything stupid and don't be a fucking hero.
Right. Once again, going to the parents first.
Yes, always going to the parents to incapacitate them.
Because they're the biggest threat, I imagine.
Yes.
Yeah.
So Julie then screams for her four children to get out of the house.
Right.
She's basically screaming like, run. He ties John and Julie's hands with copper wire, gags them, and basically does the whole, I just want what cash you have in the house thing. So once again, bit of a red herring. He does grab $35 from the bedside table and goes into the girls' bedroom. And we know they all sleep together in bunk beds.
In bunk beds.
And here they find the four girls petrified as they'd heard their mother scream. Sharon was pretending to be asleep. That's how scared she was.
Oh, no.
He then grabs Sharon, and the reason why we think he had read the article is he calls her by name. Oh. He says, Sharon, come with me.
But he also seems to do a lot of research.
Yes.
And he knows these houses inside out. He knows that the key's going to be left inside. So potentially, yeah, obviously. But I also wouldn't put it past him if he just knows, for instance.
No.
Where was Sharon in the children, like in terms of the siblings? Was she the youngest? Like,
I think she was kind of mid.
One of the two or three. Yeah. Okay.
So here's where the escalation occurs. He didn't take her to the bathroom in the house like the previous victim.
Yeah.
He kidnaps her instead.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Now, he drives for an unknown period of time, but it's a fair distance according to Sharon, but still in the suburbs. These kids we're going to talk about, their descriptions of what happens are phenomenal given the trauma they would have suffered.
No way, really.
Absolutely phenomenal. Now, it took John and Julie, the parents, about 15 minutes to free themselves from the shackles.
They would have been petrified. They would have been so scared.
And John immediately runs to the neighbors to get help and call police.
Yep.
Now, police are now aware of how dangerous this offender is because they're like, these two cases are obviously linked.
Phone lines cut, parents targeted first. Like
same age daughter same targeted.
Same age daughter, yeah. And they're not far away, Ringwood and Lower Plains.
No.
Is that? Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
So they spring into action very quickly.
Yeah.
So remember DNA, it's in literal infancy. CCTV is not as prevalent as it was now.
Yeah.
So it's like boots on the ground police work.
Yeah, okay.
So like canvases, door knocks, stopping vehicles coming in and out of the area. They also set up a police van so people can come and give tips in the area if they remember anything.
Did they get the scouts involved? Do you know how like in some of these cases they
thankfully
get like
they didn't try and traumatize more children.
Yeah.
There's also videos, footage of them going down into sewers, walking on roofs of houses, like all in search of like whatever clues they can find.
So they're literally ants across the suburbs, like finding anything they can, you know, about Sharon.
Yeah, because she's missing now and they know time is of the essence.
Yeah, okay.
It's very important.
Yeah.
Now, at 11 p.m. on the 27th of December, so this is day after, a motorist is driving in Bayswater when he notices a vehicle he thought looked a bit sus.
27th December?
Yes.
That was a day of.
Day of?
That was, well, that's what you said before.
Yeah, okay, so because she was kidnapped in the very early hours of the morning.
So just later that day then?
Yeah.
Okay.
11 p.m.
11 p.m.
So almost the next day.
Almost, sorry.
Yeah.
Yep.
So the vehicle had its headlights turned off and it actually almost hit another vehicle because of it. So he's like, weird. So he actually decides to follow the vehicle.
Oh, wow.
Which was a Holden Commodore, and he actually pulls up right next to him at a red light. He tries to talk to the driver, but the driver had his like face turned away and it was quite obvious he didn't want to engage or show his face.
Yeah.
He then... like he did say he looked like the only one in the vehicle at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And when the light turned green, he drove off.
And like a 10-year-old girl, she's like possibly in the boot or in the back seat lying down, like you're not going to see her.
Yes. Unfortunately, he didn't get the license plate, which to be fair, you might not think to do that.
No.
Around 45 minutes later, around midnight-ish, so this is about almost 18 hours after she's gone missing, a woman was driving on Orchard Road in Bayswater near an electrical substation. Electrical substation is an important fact. When she spots a young girl wearing only garbage bags and a man's T-shirt, she obviously pulls over because this is like a 10-year-old girl dressed in garbage bags in the middle of the night near an electrical substation. And Sharon tells her she's been dumped out of a man's car and she was kidnapped before. She also states she was originally dumped on the grounds of Bayswater High School.
Okay.
So police immediately called and she's taken to a local hospital to be medically examined. You can't imagine the relief of the parents.
Yeah, but also just the absolute sheer horror. Like what has happened to Sharon? What has she been through? Oh. Is she okay?
Okay,
they found her and she's safe, but
yeah.
You know, that doesn't necessarily mean she's safe
make sense.
Fuck.
Now, you can imagine the parents, like I said, relief, but it wouldn't last long, as you said, because they now have to talk about the ordeal she went to. And like I said, she was surprisingly helpful. Now, we obviously don't know specific details about her assault. We don't need to.
Yeah, we don't want to know.
But one thing she did say was that when he wasn't assaulting her, he was very calm and courteous. And he even gave her food and water during that time.
Okay.
Now, she stated she was gagged and blindfolded throughout the entire assault. And he was very adamant about her not seeing his face. That was one thing. But he left the room at one time and Sharon, you know, with all her guts, decided to lift her blindfold for just a moment.
Jeez.
And here she sees something which is not only incredibly creepy, but also if it's ever located would be the ultimate clue. She sees a video camera.
Oh, so he's recording himself.
He's recording what's happening.
What a deviant.
Yeah. So she also manages here to detail the entire layout of the bedroom, including colours of the bedhead, curtain and blanket.
Wow.
She also informed police that, once again, as with the unknown victim, he was meticulous about making sure she was clean before he released her. He made her bathe a number of times, brush and floss her teeth, and she also detailed the layout of the bathroom where that occurred and also where that bathroom was in relation to the bedroom.
Jeez, for 10 years old, that's incredible. Amazing. As you said, that's impressive at the best of times, let alone given what this poor little girl's gone through.
A 10-year-old girl. Phenomenal.
That's unbelievable. So he's got a real thing of cleanliness. Now, is that to remove any...
I think it's to remove evidence.
Evidence, that's what I want. Yeah, he's... Okay.
I don't think it's like an OCD kind of thing. It's a...
No.
Like part of his...
He does seem a bit OCD though, in other ways. Like he is very meticulous. He is maybe not OCD, that's the wrong word, but he's very careful, very meticulous.
I think he's a very good and experienced criminal.
Right,
and knows what he's doing.
Yeah, okay.
Now, she said his car sounded like an older model car when she was in it. It didn't sound like a new car. It had that old car sound.
No way.
She said he took her clothes and placed the garbage bags on her, and she's like, he was very, you know, meticulous from start to finish. She also informs them of something very interesting. She heard planes landing throughout the entire time she was there.
Well, this is late 80s. Melbourne doesn't have a lot of airports, so...
No, so they're somewhere near a flight path.
Near the airport because they're landing.
Mm.
It's not like where we are where you've got planes flying overhead. It's like that's a flight path. They're landing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. She said she could tell by the sound of how they were coming in that they were landing.
Okay. So not actually like wheels hitting tarmac landing.
No, more like it goes from softer to louder.
Okay. Understood.
Yep.
And she was picked up at the Bayswater station,
power station. Yep.
Okay. How long was she walking for? Because surely that would also...
So she was dumped at Bayswater High School, around the corner.
Yeah, okay.
So police are obviously still trying to investigate, but they've got nothing. They've got absolutely nothing. And once again, these crimes fade from the public's mind.
Right.
18 months would pass before he once again resurfaces and escalates.
So he's got a pattern and an MO here.
He does seem to wait that 18-month period until everything calms down.
Yep.
And then continues onwards.
Right.
So it's the 3rd of June 1990, and this time the attack took place in Canterbury.
Melbourne, in Victoria?
They're all in the general vicinity of each other, these suburbs.
Okay.
So just before midnight, 13-year-old Nicola and her 15-year-old sister Fiona were asleep in their bed. The sisters were home alone because the parents had gone out for the night to a farewell party. This man enters through the back door again and he makes his way directly to the girl's bedroom. So he knows the parents aren't there and he knows the girls will be alone.
And he knows the layout of the house.
Yes. So here, once again, armed with a knife and a gun, he wakes the girls at 11:30 p.m. Now, he used his usual threats to comply, all that kind of stuff. He then ties up Fiona and told her that when her father returns, new red herring, he needs to give $25,000 for Nicola's safe return.
Right. So it's a ransom.
It's a ransom now. So he makes Nicola go and find her school uniform. She went to PLC and some clean underwear as well.
So PLC, Victoria. This is all very confusing. Canterbury, PLC. Sydney, inner west.
Yeah, same suburb, same schools. No, we're definitely in Melbourne.
Okay.
She went to PLC. He said, get your school uniform and some clean underwear.
Okay.
As he was taking Nicola from the house, he took some car keys to a rental vehicle the family had and he drives away with her.
Right.
So he's stolen the family car, in inverted commas. Now, the parents would not be home for another 40 minutes. And that's when they found the bound and gagged Fiona, and she tells them everything about what's happened.
Jeez.
So they would be frantic. They've just heard she's been abducted, $25,000, and police are called, quick to renew their manhunt.
Yeah, they're because they're like,
definitely same person. We've seen this before. Maybe there's new evidence on this crime scene.
Is he still wearing his balaclava during the whole thing?
Whole time he wears his same balaclava.
Insane. And at this point, 1990, DNA is now starting to become a bit more relevant. I know it's still in its infancy.
Yeah, it's in its infancy. It is
a little bit more careful.
Yeah. So at 3 p.m. the next day, the 4th of June,
mm-hmm.
The car he was stole, like the car he stole when he took Nicola away, was found dumped a few streets away.
Okay.
So he'd clearly been smart enough to stash a car he had in the nearby streets, steal the car from the house, dump it just in case anybody saw him.
Saw him, yeah.
And then take a secondary car away.
Okay.
No, the parents are like, we will pay whatever fucking money he wants. Like when he comes in, don't ask questions, don't do anything. We'll give you the money. We don't care.
Is PLC, I imagine, with a name like
a very
PLC,
wealthy school.
Very wealthy very, school. Very so they've obviously school. Got some money and they're just like, we don't care.
We don't care. Give us our daughter back.
Yeah.
They're freaking out.
Yeah, of course.
That phone call would never come.
Right. Because it's fucking red herring. It's bullshit.
Yeah, exactly. Now, people are starting now to fear the worst. Sharon was returned long before this. So she was returned within sort of the
like a day,
18
right?
hours. Yeah. Within the 18 hours. And it's coming up now to almost 50 hours.
Wow.
So just over 2 days.
I was going to say, yeah, help me out.
Yeah. So everybody is now like.
Don't they say like the first 48 is the most important? Yeah. So we've gone past that.
Yeah.
A little bit of a concern. He said he is escalating in each.
Yes.
So, okay.
So it's 2 a.m. on the 6th of July, Nicola's 14th birthday. Oh. And 50 hours after she was abducted, she was found alive.
Okay, good.
She'd been dumped outside a power station in Kew.
So a different power station.
A different power station in Kew. The male had dropped her there, still blindfolded and wrapped in a blanket. She was told to sit down with her head between her legs for 10 minutes. Once that 10 minutes was up, he said, you can get up and go and get help.
Right.
Now, Nicola, just like Sharon, very observant young girl. Incredibly observant and provided many helpful details to police. Now, he's often wearing blue overalls. So he's often seen in blue overalls.
Right.
So she informed them once again, she was given food and water during the attack but kept blindfolded the entire time. And she also stated when she wasn't being assaulted, he was very polite.
Oh, how nice of him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She also gave more information about what she heard, and that was about the planes going overhead. And she also says they're landing. But then she manages to tell them how many planes went over in an hour. So she heard the 10 o'clock news on the radio, and then she counted until the 11 o'clock news came on.
Holy shitballs.
Yeah.
I mean, I know she's a little bit older. She's 13 as opposed to 10. But I'm sorry, 13. Holy.
Amazing. These girls are amazing.
That's insane. And how, do we know how many she said?
10.
10. And so what is that going, does, like, help me out. What is that going to, what evidence is that going to give police?
Because I think you can kind of work out what runway she might, like what route that might be on. So if is it Sydney to Melbourne? Is it Melbourne to Queensland? Is it like
or like which... where over Melbourne had 10 planes go over between 10 and 11?
Exactly, yeah.
So it narrows the search area, I suppose. And he sounds like a bloody, he's like a, if I'm going to guess here based on the information you give me, he works in electricity. Like he works in that field as like a.
It's always been a theory. It's always been a theory.
Okay.
Now, they do manage to lock it down to one specific runway, which I'll discuss in a second.
Yeah.
Now, she also said he took a big interest in the media coverage of her case, including like when her father made a plea to the media.
Yeah.
Commenting on it to her and talking to her about it.
What would he say?
So I couldn't really find the information, but I think he was just talking with her about it, general. Like chit-chat. I don't want to say chit-chat because that sounds like two people talking. But he's sort of discussing that her father is playing for her and, you know, all this kind of stuff.
Doesn't sound like he would be taunting. Like from what they've all said, all the girls have said, it's like he's not sadistic about it.
Mm.
Like don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to defend him or like sing his praises whatsoever. But it's like it might just be something along the lines of like, oh, you know, have you seen this? Like that's your dad kind of thing. I don't fucking know.
Because it is one of those things where he's an odd offender in the fact that he treats them well when he's not attacking them. And he even wasn't violent during, apart from the obvious, the rape part of it, but he wasn't violent during it. Mm. So it was this odd.
He probably thinks that he's like got some sort of, I don't know, like, oh, I'm a gentleman. I'm a gentleman pedophile.
Yeah, exactly. So here's an aside where we only very recently locked down that flight path.
Right.
So 60 Minutes got like a geographical crime expert in to see if they could work out the flight path and what areas the victims may have been taken to.
So and when if they was were sort this? Of taken 60 Minutes
like
thing?
Recently, like within the last couple of years.
Oh, wow. Okay. Mm. So we're fast forwarding.
Yes. Because I just want to let you know about the airstrip because it does become relevant a bit later on. That's why I said there's like random asides coming in and out.
Fair.
So the airstrip they locked it down was to Tulla Marine, which is the main airport in Melbourne.
Yeah.
And it tracks from east to west, the airport.
Okay.
So with this in mind, the areas where the girls were held had to be the northeastern suburbs of Melbourne, which is still a massive area, but it's a little bit more locked down than anywhere in Melbourne.
Yeah, exactly.
So the day Nicola was abducted and heard the planes, there were winds coming from the north and blowing in a southerly direction. Now, because of this, most planes would have landed like from the easterly direction and the sound of the planes would have travelled more to the south on the winds. It all gets very complex, but know that most of the sound would have travelled on the winds to the south.
Yes.
So this narrowed down the region to the southern end of the flight paths.
So southern end of northeast Melbourne.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, this is around an area of like a 20-minute circumference drive.
Oh, okay.
Basically. So he needs to be familiar with that area, they think.
Yes.
So that's kind of the area they sort of locked it down to.
Yeah.
Both of the girls have been dumped near electrical substations, mm-hmm. which was an important connection to note. They also lived near electrical substations.
Who did? The girls?
The victims.
Oh, okay.
So then the question is raised, is it the location itself, like the electrical substations, or is it the isolation those substations offer for dumping them? Basically.
Column A, column B, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Potentially.
So one suggestion was that if he was an electrical worker who does maintenance on things like poles and wires, was that where he was doing his surveillance from?
Yeah, that's
Nobody's going to think twice about an electrical worker up a pole. You're like, oh, there's a guy up a pole.
100%.
They're doing works, whatever.
And he's like getting vantage points inside the house. It's like nobody's like, as you said, they then become invisible, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because nobody ever looks up. That was always a thing we learned in the cops. Nobody ever looks up, look up.
Mm.
Just one of those things.
But it's also like even when like garbage men come.
Yeah.
Like I don't actually, I know they're out there, but I don't know what the fuck they're doing. Because it's like, but if I hear anybody rustling out in front of the house, like I'm kind of just like, oh, what's going on out there? But then if I hear if I know it's the garbage men, I guess what I'm trying to say is like I look past that because I'm just like it just becomes part of the normal.
Yeah, it's normal.
And that's the thing. If you see somebody climbing a power post, like you'd be like, oh, okay, cool. Yeah, you might clock it, but then you don't actually think anything of it. You're not going to be like, oh, that's strange. What is that person? Is that person looking inside my house? No, whatever. Unless like, as you said, unless you look up and, but yeah.
You see it. So plus Nicola's family's house also backed onto power lines. So they lived in a house that backs onto those empty lots where the power poles come down. We watched a Love It Or List It where they looked at a house that had the power lines behind it and decreased the value.
Yeah.
Which suggests familiarity with the area because that's also a no-through road.
What is?
Where Nicola lives and where the power lines are.
Oh, right. Okay. So like there's no other reason.
Nobody would really have a reason to go down that street.
Unless they knew what they were doing.
To further this theory, the neighbour of Nicola's said her brothers saw an odd man filming over the back fence of Nicola's house in the days leading up to the abduction. He was described as 30 to 35, a bit overweight, longish hair on the sides but balding on top. And he apparently was visibly shocked when he like clocked the boys and saw them and they saw him. And these witnesses reported it because they'd heard what was happening and they heard about the girls and they knew Nicola and the police just did not follow up.
Oh, that – well, I don't know. I know it happened 18 months ago, but you've got to be aware of what's going on, surely. Like it's
surely.
And because in Sharon's case, we knew that he had a camcorder thing, right?
Yeah.
Video camera.
Yeah, so police never followed it up.
Mm.
So although no further clues or forensic evidence came from Nicola's assault, they had a vague idea of the physical characteristics by this point. So from the parents and the other, like the family members and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So he's described as Caucasian with an Australian accent, between 30 to 50, 173 to 180 centimetres tall, medium build with a small pot belly, fair or sandy hair because they could kind of see it through the balaclava sometimes. And these are very consistent with the description those boys gave of the man looking over the fence.
Okay.
So he should have been followed up on. And that's only ever been now re-released with this 60 Minutes episode.
No way. No, serious. Yeah. So then if that's the case, I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, sorry. Yeah, keep going.
So he's also using at this point very specific phrases like bozo or worrywart or missy. So like it was kind of clocked as being odd phrases that not everybody uses.
It's like really PG Australian, like, ah, you bozo, oh, don't be a worry wart.
Yeah, and like saying, come on, Missy. Come on. Like, yeah.
It's just bullshit by the sound of it.
Yeah.
What was it? Do we know what that was about?
No.
But it was just consistent.
Something individual that the girls had noted.
Yeah.
And this was all they had. Only evidence they managed to obtain. And they can't. It's almost like a wait and see at this point in time to see if he'll strike again.
Does he?
9 months later.
Oh, okay. So half the time this time.
So it's the evening of the 13th of April and Carmen Chan, 13 years old, was babysitting her two younger siblings, Carly and Karen, while her parents, Phyllis and John, were working at their local Chinese restaurant.
What was her name again?
Carmen.
And but how it's spelled
K-A-R-M-E-I-N.
Yeah.
She's 13.
Okay.
So interesting to note that both Carmen and Nicola, these crimes happened during the school holidays and they both attend the same private school. They both go to PLC.
PLC, right. Yeah. Okay.
Which is right near another electrical substation.
Okay. He's an electrician or he's an electrical engineer. He works at these substations. There's something there because everything is connected with a substation of some sort.
Yeah.
Where they're located, the school, everything. Do we know why he asked Nicola to take a school uniform?
No.
Did he? I don't know.
It suggested that maybe it's a fetish thing.
I was going to say, did he make a wearer?
I don't know any details of the assault, and I didn't try and find out.
That's probably good. So she was 13, went to PLC as well.
Yeah, looking after her two younger sisters while the parents are working at their Chinese restaurant.
Do we know if where they lived was around a substation?
I don't know.
No, that's fine.
No. Now, to set the scene of this home, to show the brazenness of this attack, it's not an easy home to get into. There's a brick fence over 2 meters high that lines the entire property. The only access, it's kind of like a fortress almost. Yeah. The only access point is through a security gate of the same height.
Okay.
So around 9 p.m., the offender, Mr. Cruel, attempts to tamper with the security gate, not successful, so just climbs the brick fence.
So he attempts to. Does that mean he's got experience? I mean, what am I trying to tamper with an electrical gate? I wouldn't have a fucking clue.
No. Oh, my God. Imagine if he worked in an electrical substation.
Oh, yeah. That's what I'm saying. It just kind of adds to that theory that he's an electrician of some sort, right?
100%. 100%. He's not successful, so he scales the wall, basically. Gets and once inside the property, there's no reason for anyone walking to the street to view his presence as odd because he's inside a closed gate. Fenced off.
He's obviously been invited in. Nobody's going to be able to,
So now he can kind of relax a little bit more due to him being in what appears to be a very secure home.
And I imagine because he's done his research, he knows the parents are out.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Knows they're working at their Chinese restaurant.
Yeah.
So not only that, he'd likely been surveilling the house and its comings and goings and knew the parents would work these days at their, probably most nights, at their local Chinese restaurant.
Yep.
As he's at the front of the house, he sees one of the cars parked there and he's brought a can of spray paint and he spray paints on it, payback, more to come, and Asian drug deal.
What? Yeah. Okay, so he's just all about the red herring bullshit, isn't
yes,
he?
Yes, yeah. Now, this time he actually enters without a gun and just with the knife, possibly because he knew the parents wouldn't be home and a knife is enough to scare kids.
Yeah, of course.
His face is once again covered by the balaclava.
Mm-hmm.
And the Chan sisters are upstairs in their bedroom watching TV together when they hear a noise. Now, all three sisters went into the hallway outside their bedroom to investigate because maybe I think they're innocent kids. They're probably like, oh, mom and dad came home early. Like, oh, cool.
Yeah.
Now, it was here they were confronted by a man in a balaclava and I can't imagine how scared those girls were.
I was going to say that's absolutely terrifying.
I would be petrified. And he's standing there holding a knife. Jesus. He drags the three children back into the bedroom. And the man told the two youngest to go into the cupboard. And as he was doing so, he told the girls he only wanted money. And once he left, Carmen would open the cupboard doors for them and let them out.
Hmm.
So once they were inside, he pushed the bed up against the cupboard doors so that they couldn't get out and drags Carmen out by her hair.
Right.
Now, around 9:45 p.m., once he'd abducted Carmen, Carly and Karen actually managed to escape from inside the cupboard and they called their parents immediately.
Right.
Now, Phyllis and John immediately rushed home to see Carly and Karen and no Carmen. So they're called police and police are like coming there on force. They see the parallels. They know that this is probably another case. We know it's escalating. We need to get on top of this ASAP.
Were the phone lines cut?
I don't know for this one.
Yeah, probably doesn't need to be
probably
once again.
Need to.
Yeah.
So the family were, of course, no, they didn't, because Carmen called the parents. The kids called the parents.
Of course, of course.
So the family, of course, were distraught and answers aren't coming quickly. But police are now doing, once again, door knocks, canvassing, everything. They quickly dismiss the Asian gang graffiti, as Phyllis and John were quite upstanding members of the community. Their local restaurant was very well known.
It's just some stereotypical racist bullshit red herring, yeah, right?
It is something that does bring some controversy as to whether Carmen's case is linked to the others. Some people believe it's not. Some people believe it is. Yeah. So there is a little bit of controversy there, just to mention.
Is it only because of the spray paint? Or because, I mean, we know that Seth Gonzalez did the same shit, right?
Yeah. Like, we'll talk about another reason why they think that.
Oh, okay.
So at this point in time, everyone's now changing how they view the safety of their children.
Yeah.
And even the children themselves are petrified. Oh. Like, they're worried that they're going to be abducted. And, like, there's an interview with a kid and he's like, I don't want to be abducted.
And so, like, that's where he's becoming the real life boogeyman.
Exactly. Because he could be anywhere.
Okay. He's going to come and get you at night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So now hours turning into days, like, and days at that point is significantly longer than those girls. The 48 hours has passed. The 72 hours have passed. There's no sign of Carmen anywhere.
Because Nicola, right, she was
50 hours. And on the third day, Phyllis and John make a heartfelt appeal to the abductor to return their daughter. And it's a rough watch. Like, the mother is like, the mother holds up her daughter's favorite dress.
No.
Yeah. And she's like, Carmen, come home so you can wear your favorite dress.
Nope.
Now, police are holding on hope and trying to find any clues they can, but they don't have anything. And hours have turned to days. Days have turned to weeks. And now weeks are turning into months.
Okay.
And hope is slowly starting to fade. Then, almost a year after her abduction, on the 9th of April, 1992, a man is walking his dog through the grounds of an electrical substation in Thomastown, which is about 16 kilometres from where she was abducted. And there, he locates a human skull.
Oh, fuck. Is that near her home? Is that near anything?
Like, no, 16 kilometres from where she was abducted.
Yeah, I don't know. Kilometres, like, that's a long way, right?
Yeah.
That's like 40-minute, 30-minute drive?
No, because 40 minutes would be like 30, 40Ks.
Oh, okay. That's if you, yeah, okay.
I'm thinking about getting to Blacktown on a highway. No, it would be like,
okay, but yeah, yeah, it's not hugely close, and found a skull. That's, yeah.
So the ground, this is, I hate this. The grounds around where the skull were found were starting to be used as landfill, and in that particular area, earthworks had started to be done, and that's likely what caused the skull to become visible and to be, like, moved up from its shallow grave. So police attend fearing the worst. They pretty much know what they're about to find. They locate the rest of her body in close proximity to where the skull was found. The remains are sent to forensics, who confirm everybody's worst fear. The body is that of Carmen. Now, the escalation here is concerning for police. He is now abducting and murdering. And because, and this is also one of the reasons why they're like, is this connected to the other girls, because he's escalated to murder. Yeah. It seems like he's quite content to return them.
No, he's been escalating every single case from, it has been from the first girl to Sharon to Nicola and now to Carmen. Every single one has been escalated. It's been leading to murder. Like,
and he's been so clear about, don't see my face. What if she also just took a peek and saw his face?
Yeah, true.
Now, one of the reasons also they do say this and like, oh, is it an Asian gang, is because her skull had 3 bullet wounds in an execution style.
Right.
So they also were like, oh, the family owned those 2 Chinese restaurants. Are there actually links between Asian gangs? Like, what would be the go here? Many police do believe, and I've looked at some more like recent interviews, that drug link was not investigated thoroughly enough. It could have been looked into in a little bit more detail. They were very quick to link all the cases and not quick to look at things that might exclude it from being a victim of Mr. Krull.
Okay, understood.
Now, one reason, though, that police do keep going back to Mr. Krull is because they know he loves a good red herring, and he would be like, it's not unknown for him to go there and spray paint a car.
Exactly.
As a red herring.
Or say shit. And we know that he had a gun.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, I'm just thinking in terms of the, well, yeah, the police, you said the police didn't investigate it, but like, did anything else happen to to the family after this? Like, I'm just assuming if it is drug or Asian gang related.
Mm, no, absolutely like, nothing.
It, does it just end with Carmen and they don't know? Like, I don't know.
Yeah, it ends with Carmen. And the mother also said, like, Carmen was like a feisty, sassy young girl and she's not likely to go without a fight or likely to, like, keep fighting during.
Yeah, good.
So that's why there's the possibility she did try and see his face and he's killed her.
That's right.
And once again, this is my thought is, did he do the execution style to once again try and link it back to drugs?
To do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he's also very meticulous, right? We know that about him. It kind of, to me, it's not out of the ordinary. Like it, that seems like that would be, given how organized he is and sort of like rigidly sort of routine in the way he's gone about all of these home invasions and, you know, abductions and like it kind of fits that profile, I would imagine.
I think so.
You know, that he would do it that way rather than being really messy because nothing he has done so far, the only mistake he's made is be seen by those boys.
Yeah. Agreed.
And then, like, but that's it. He's not really made any mistakes. So doing execution style kind of fits that.
Mm.
I'm not saying that it is because
we're hypothesizing.
We're hypothesizing because, yeah, if the police didn't investigate thoroughly, well, then you can never rule it out.
Now, look, I know we're sort of writing off the strength of the police investigation here, but they did exhaust a lot of avenues.
Yeah.
Over 30,000 houses were like looked at to see if they had the layout that the girls had described. So they're essentially the way the like a bedroom is towards the bathroom.
Yeah.
And they sort of apparently did this by sort of posing as like electrical workers or gas inspectors going into the house, seeing if it did, and if it did, getting a search warrant.
Oh, geez. Imagine how ironic posing as electrical workers, right?
I know.
Yeah.
And then also 27,000 people were spoken to. So police aren't fucking about.
They are. Like it sounds like they probably should have moved on that tip off, but I'm not going to – that is a really difficult one as well because it's not – it doesn't – might not – in hindsight, absolutely. It's like, what the fuck? What are you doing? But then like somebody – a couple of kids say, oh, there was a bit of a strange guy. They're probably like, yeah, all right. You know, like that happens. Peeping Toms back in the 80s and 90s.
Mm, not – Yeah, it was common.
They were much more prevalent than now. Yeah, so it's sort of it does seem like they've been trying to do and they've mobilised when they've needed to.
100%. They also contact – because they're very sure that this is not his first crimes.
Oh, can't
it's, be. He's too organised. So they start going to local doctors and GPs to see if they could get any victims that had presented for sexual assault that didn't want to come forward.
Yeah.
Now it's becoming – like police are now like, oh, we're like, we don't want him to strike again. We don't want any more victims. So, like, we need, like, we.
How do you stop that, though?
Exactly.
Like, how do you stop somebody just going into a random house with a gun and a knife?
Mm.
Like, you can't be on every street corner.
And police, they're pretty, like, I looked at some interviews with police about this later, like, sort of within the last 10 years. And they're pretty vague about leads they had. But vague in that way that they had a suspicion who they thought it was. But they couldn't prove it.
It's not what you know. What you can prove.
Exactly. Now, detectives do think that there were 12 victims in total.
Oh, wow.
Now, I couldn't find the details of all the victims, but I could find the detail of one. And the first confirmed attack, that was the first confirmed attack they could link to him. And that was in 1985. So that's 2 years before the attack on the unnamed girl.
Yeah.
So the details I know is that she was 14 at the time and she was attacked by a man in a balaclava. One thing she recounted, which was very interesting, was something that he said to her.
Bozo?
He said, "My liberty, my freedom is more important than your life," which would make sense why he would have murdered Carmen.
Carmen, because she threatens that by, like you said, looking at him, seeing his face, well, then that's a threat to his freedom and liberty.
Yep, 100%.
Right.
And she's also released. Where do you think she's released?
In a substation.
Electrical substation. So, yeah, I do believe for that reason the Carmen Chan case is linked.
Yeah.
But who am I?
Oh, that's it. Who are we? Mm. We don't know. We don't know shit.
So we're going to have a little aside here about forensics in the case. So DNA in the beginning, bad, could have certainly been good now.
Well, but it's not bad. It's just non-existent.
Non-existent. But I meant like, it's new.
Yeah.
So for this reason, a lot of evidence was handled poorly because we weren't so particular about our DNA.
You don't know what you don't know, right?
Exactly. But many pieces of evidence were just not able to be found.
Like what?
In the earlier crimes. Some witness statements were even missing. Yeah. One such piece was a piece of evidence they believe was his first crime. So remember the woman said she was tied up to a bed? 1985 crime?
Oh, yeah. The 14-year-old?
Yes.
Yes.
The young girl, sorry.
Young girl, yeah.
She's a woman when she – I saw the documentary and she comes in. She's blacked out, but she comes in and talks about it.
Understood, yep.
Now, one piece of evidence was the rope. Police confiscated the rope that she was tied up with. Great source of DNA. No, don't know. Can't tell you where it is.
What do you mean? Why?
Missing.
What?
Missing.
What? No, well, that's not.
Yep. Missing. Yeah.
How?
That along with a bunch of witness statements.
Like it may not be enough to, you know, you don't know where you're going to get off that. You may not have been able to get a profile or anything. But then you might have been able to fucking get a profile and prosecute the prick.
Yeah, exactly. Because like
almost said
it would have like rubbed.
Yeah.
It would have rubbed. It could probably be a great source of DNA.
Exactly.
And those like fibers will hold it well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It does seem like though he's none of his details would be on file though.
No, you're ready for the worst part.
Oh no.
With her, his first victim, he did not use a condom and he ejaculated and those swabs are missing.
No.
Yeah.
Hang on, what do you mean missing? How do these things go missing?
I have no fucking idea. I have no idea. Probably destroyed, let's be honest. We got like destroyed or accidentally destroyed or.
Because a woman's getting raped, like, it's the 80s.
Or like they just.
Did they even believe her? Bleh.
They were probably just like, bleh. Like, yeah, I don't know.
I don't understand. Mm. I don't understand.
Yeah.
Like, as I said, the police up until that point, I was like, they're doing a pretty good job. And maybe after that point, yes, they did. But you can't excuse that. What the fuck happened?
A lot of DNA evidence has now been lost. Yeah.
Like what, even since the 87 and 88 cases? Like
there was
those?
Really no kind of evidence. So
when he was trying out, when he was in his, like when he was dumb and making mistakes like this, when he did leave evidence, the cops fucking lost it.
And then afterwards he did not.
And then he learned from that and he didn't leave any evidence.
Yes. Now, interestingly though, this was the first case where the Victorian police had tried to create a psychological profile of a killer.
Mm.
And this was actually done in conjunction with the FBI's behavioral unit.
Yeah, right.
And they described him as an individual who would have seemed quite normal to his neighbours involved in the community. He would murder future victims. He's just that very kind of psychopathic profile of a person.
Sounds like half our cases.
Yeah. So basically they said he was quite normal from the outside, which would make him hard to find because nobody notices a normal person.
Yeah.
Yeah. But now the
question, well done, FBI. Fucking you cracked the case, mate.
Yeah.
I was like waiting for more.
No.
So just that he's a normal person who can hold a conversation.
Basically.
But he's willing to murder and kill people. Be a pedophile.
Yeah. Yeah. But now years are passing and nothing's happening.
Right.
And no more murders, no more abductions. So the question remains, why has he stopped killing?
He's died.
So, once again, this does not fit with the profile yet because he said he'll keep killing until he's caught.
Yeah.
Some believe he died. Others believe the shock of killing Carmen made him stop offending. I don't agree with that. Now, yeah, because I think you know how like those killers are like, I'm so smart, I've got the ego, I'm so good at this.
Yeah, Daniel Kelsey last week.
Yeah, exactly. So my strongest theory would be that he died.
That's what I'm thinking.
Theory.
Like he's
or was like incarcerated.
For like another crime or something. Yeah. And because they lost their DNA, they couldn't then link him with any of these. Yeah, right. Okay.
Some do also believe he moved interstate.
But would that have stopped him?
Well, they're like no police forces communicated back then.
Yeah, but
so there might
have been
like an abduction.
Yeah.
And then he might have moved on to another state, but they might not think to link those two abductions. Like it's just... I don't want to say it's just another abduction, but it's an abduction and they're like, okay, this happened, but we don't know what the fuck's happening in New South Wales. So, I mean, Melbourne, sorry, Victoria. So like,
Yeah. Or he's gone overseas. He's gone international. Yeah. But he seemed very Australian.
Very Australian and very familiar. Doing that very sort of typical killing within the familiar area.
But that's why I kind of don't, I mean, look, unless he had to move, I don't really give. Once again, hypotheses, right? We're having a drink and we're throwing around ideas based on little we know. But it's just because a lot of that relied on his knowledge of the area, right? Like of the stuff, and it was all connected through substations.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like, it doesn't, I don't know, I feel like the idea of going interstate and doing it once and then moving again, like he doesn't have that familiarity, which is his big thing. He doesn't have that time to prepare and to scope out, do that meticulous research.
Now, I'm not sure if I mentioned this, but that electrical substation link only came through the 60 Minutes documentary.
What, so none of the police realised, like, where all these girls were found?
No.
So, okay, look, I understand the police were getting boots on the ground and everything, but what the fuck did they do otherwise?
I think it's also because...
Like, that's a pretty common... I know I'm being a bit harsh, but, like, I would have thought they're linking it quickly enough, which is good. But you would have thought you could connect where each girl was found, right? That's a pretty obvious one, I would have thought.
Yeah, I think so.
Right.
Now, they did find some suspects. There's one I like. Now, one who was a former lecturer at the University of Melbourne.
Ooh.
So, once again, very prominent person, fits the profile, and his name was Brian Enkler. Now, one reason they suspected him was that in the 1970s, he was jailed for 10 years for tying up and sexually assaulting 6 girls over a period of 2 years.
And he became a lecturer after that?
I think it was during. Was his job, and he was assaulting these girls while he was working as a professor.
Okay, understood.
They did apply for a search warrant for his house during the attack.
Yeah.
And they did find a balaclava and a knife in the attic of his house.
Mm-hmm.
But at that point in time, it was an impossible case to prove. He like battened down the hatches, wouldn't talk to them. It's like, we have a balaclava and a knife. Like, it's not enough. Mm-hmm. It's not enough for a criminal to have a balaclava and a knife, because how many criminals have a balaclava and a knife? Yeah. We've got nothing to connect you to these girls. So they had to drop that as a suspect.
What kind of knife was it? Like, was it a proper like Rambo kind of like hunting knife?
I'm not sure, to be honest. It certainly wasn't a kitchen knife.
Oh, okay. So, yeah.
And if it was a kitchen knife, it was like a knife block kitchen knife. Like a proper. Big one.
Yeah.
Like
not a cleaver, but a butcher's knife.
A proper
type
knife,
of thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Understood.
So, yeah, they thought maybe one of the reasons why he didn't strike again was because they looked at Brian Enkler, and Brian Enkler got spooked and was like, I want to go back to jail again. And he's like, I'm out.
Yeah, maybe.
Now, another suspect is thrown around too. This is my bet. So we're going to start with a guy called – this is going to be a story. We start with a guy called Alfie Gay. And he and a friend were heavily involved in the MSS security office heist in 1970. So basically they walked in and stole the entire payroll of the Ford factory.
How?
Like 46 pallets of cash. I think it's back then
cash.
Yeah, because like you got paid in cash sometimes back then, like payroll was different to what it is. So they just walked and took pallets of money.
That makes way more sense than me thinking they just walked in and then stole a hard drive that somehow contained money, because I'm an idiot.
Because it's the 70s.
And I don't understand how things work, apparently.
Because, it's like the 70s then.
So he's okay, wow. So it's like a heist, like a proper like – heist.
He was a major and respected armed robber, like genuinely a fuck off armed robber.
What was his Alfie
and
Gay?
And he had he was facing huge charges for importing like shitloads of meth.
Right.
At the time. Wow.
Because back in Melbourne and even Australia, but like back the 60s and 70s, armed robbery was the thing.
Huge. Massive.
Yeah.
So in the early 2000s, Detective Ron Idles, and I've spoken about him before, Detective Ron Idles actually went to speak to Alfie.
We like Ron Idles.
We love Ron Idles. So he chatted with him, and as he was leaving and sort of getting – they just sort of chatted about old crimes and stuff like that. And Ron's like, okay, you haven't given me anything, see the fuck later. And as he's getting into the car, Alfie knocks on the window and goes, actually, I've got something to tell you. He comes back inside, and Alfie tells him he's got terminal cancer.
Oh.
And he wants to get something off his chest before he dies. And he just looks at him and goes, do you want to know who Mr. Krull is? So, like, Riddles is like, yes. Yes, I do.
Riddles?
Idles. Autocorrect.
I love it because it is Ron Idles. It's R. Idles. Yeah, Riddles. Yeah.
And he mentioned a guy by the name of Normie Lee. Norman Lee.
Yeah. Fucking, it is him.
Yeah. Now, Lee was a prominent figure in the gang who undertook the Great Bookie robbery.
I was literally going to be like, when we're talking about the heist, I didn't want to say it, but I was like, yeah, we've got that on our to-do episodes. Yeah, right. Yeah.
And basically, to summarise, it was in 1976 where $90 million was stolen.
It's insane.
It's wild.
It's wild.
So we will cover
that. Was Alfie Gay part of that?
I don't think so. Normie Lee was in this sort of, we'll cover Normie Lee because like I was reading this and I'm like, ah.
Wah.
Yeah.
Because, okay, because back then there was a real code of, like, there was a criminal's honour. Like, you know, back in those times where it was sort of like, yeah, okay, you might punch a bloke up or you would do this or that. But I think anything, it's sort of like what exists today a little bit. But like,
these were like, you know, you think of, you know, bikie gangs and you think they were respected criminals.
Yeah.
But it's almost like this is a different level of respect. These were genuine fuck off criminals. Like they stole $90 million.
Oh, yeah, exactly. But it's also like there was a level of when they got older where they sort of, Gary Jubelin talks about it, where like he had, you know, former crims that would, one guy like bit off a fucking jail guard's nose or something like that. And it's just like he was super feared and everything, but then he got old. And then like they just had this like kind of unspoken sort of respect towards one another. There was more of that, I feel.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what I'm sensing between Ron Edwards and Alfie Gay is sort of like, oh, look, hey. Sort of like how people, they spar, they fight, and then at the end they're like, all right, good show. Like, I respect you. You're an opponent.
And it was a generation where a lot of the cops then had respect for what they called the good criminals, where they're like, you're a good crim.
Yeah.
Like, you're not a good guy, but you're very good at what you do.
Yeah.
And in the case of the Great Bookie robbery, it's believed that Normie Lee was the one who basically came up with the plan.
No way.
Very well researched, very intelligent man.
Right.
So he's, But outside of his crimes, he was a very well-respected businessman. In fact, get this, his family pioneered Chico Rolls. They invented Chico Rolls.
I was never a fan, I have to admit.
I love them so good.
No.
And like the takeaway Dim Sims, like the frozen Dim Sims. So that's like he was from like genuine money.
Like from Dim Sim, was he?
Dim Sim and Chico Rolls.
In Adelaide, Chico Rolls are massive. And when I lived as a kid growing up in Adelaide for a bit, it was just like everybody fucking loved Chico Rolls. And I was like, nah, I don't know what the fuck they are. I don't know what's in them. I want my pasty, mate.
Chico Roll.
None of this really points towards knowing anything about electricity, though. How does this? I know he's well researching everything, but it doesn't really seem like.
There's a few things we're gonna like.
Yeah.
Okay. Alfie also says that Normie had a bit of a fetish for school uniforms.
Oh, okay. So that's that Nicola PLC uniform.
Ittles, now Alfie always also said, hey, Ittles, I know you're skeptical, but we're going to go to a suburb called Eltham, where Lee had a house. And interestingly, Eltham is the same suburb where the Chans had their Chinese restaurant.
Okay.
This gets fucking wild now. Now, Eltham is smack bang in the middle of the area where Mr. Krull was suspected of having lived.
South of northeast Melbourne. Yeah.
Now, it's basically like within the triangle of the offences. I'll try and find the triangle.
Yeah.
Now, the only place that would have been slightly off was where he dumped Karen's body. Yeah. But. That is on
Karen,
the route he would have.
Carmen.
That was on the route he would have taken from Eltham to the factory where the Chico Rolls were made.
Oh.
Yeah.
There's something really wrong about that. It's almost like he ran an errand before going to work.
Oh, he discarded her like rubbish. She's disgusting. It's disgusting.
But it does explain that movement then for why he would be in that area.
100%.
From his house. Right.
Now, and that was a shock because he committed most of his crimes around the Kensington area, which is still a distance away. It's about 40 minutes away, although it is in the focus area. It's 40 minutes away.
So Kensington, what are we talking about? We're talking about lower.
Like around where like lower plenty is.
Ringwood,
all that kind of stuff.
They're all in Kensington.
So most assumed he lived there.
I love how you know the fucking geography of like northeast Melbourne, but you don't know where Newcastle is.
Because I need to research cases. Because it's about to get complicated.
Right. Okay. Yes, I'm with you.
But basically they realised he was clever and didn't shit where he slept. And so he was basically committing crimes slightly outside of where he – it's kind of complicated because we're about to move our focus area. So just bear with me for a second. I'm not explaining this well. So a few days later they go to Eltham and they head to Eltham Hotel. And he's like, I'm pretty sure he lived sort
Who's
of.
Who's he? Alfie?
Alfie and Ittles. I'm pretty sure he lived in one of the streets near the hotel, but it was many, many years ago. Like it was like 25 years ago that he was there.
So when are we, hang on, go back. When is Alfie talking to Ron Ittles?
Early 2000s.
Well, that would have been useful information.
Sorry. Yeah, it would have been. You are completely correct. Early 2000s.
So we're talking about, 10, 15 years ago.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
So he's like, oh, he's in one of these streets near here, but I'm not sure. It was a long time ago. I normally met him in the car park of the pub.
Right.
But he's like, oh, I'm going to, like, I think it's up this street.
Is he still there? Normie?
No, we'll discuss where Normie is.
Right.
Now, the issue is that many of the houses from that time have actually been demolished and, like, apartment buildings has gone up. But he's like, I'm pretty sure it was this one. He's like, I remember the house had a driveway that went straight into a garage, but that garage had been turned into a granny flat, which would explain, if that was turned into a granny flat, it would explain the configuration that the girls had described, because the bathroom was quite close to the bedroom. Okay. So a granny flat would sort of fit that description.
Okay.
And what he described the granny flat as well, how he described its layout, also fit the description the girls gave.
Okay.
So Idles believed him. He had no reason to lie. He wasn't getting revenge on Lee. And, like, he's not, like, betraying his trust in Lee. And that's because on July 28, 1992, Lee died just as the crime stopped.
I was going to say, hang on, when was Carmen was 6 months afterwards, so she was the end of 1990, is that correct? Am I getting that wrong?
Around about then, yeah.
End of 1990?
Yeah.
And no, so she was April 1991.
Yeah. So, and, like, that's, he would normally wait between 6 to 18 months. He died in 92. So that would explain why they stopped.
Fucking picked
it. Yeah. Now, Alfie had also become aware of Lee engaging in some deviant behaviour, but once again, there's the whole criminal code of you don't talk.
Who did? Who?
Lee was engaging in a few bits of deviant behaviour, i.e. pedophilia.
Alfie said that.
Yes.
Yeah, but there's also the code, like, don't, like, with kids, right? Like,
it's, yeah.
But you don't rat, you don't dog.
Yeah, I think in that case, Alfie and Normie were quite close. They were very close in their, like, criminal connection sort of thing.
Right.
Now, Idles obviously goes to the officers in charge of the task force immediately and is like, yo, I've got this information, but we don't know what eventuated from this.
Do you reckon, what's the bet they just went, it's fucking Alfie Gay. We're not listening to that. Like, what are you talking about?
Or they've, like, been like, yeah, man, it could be Normie Lee, but, like, how the fuck are we going to prove it now? We've got no DNA. We've got nothing to link him to it. All we've got is the word of this guy that's dying and he's now dead.
Was Normie Lee, he would have been arrested, right? Like, he would have been charged with things, so they would have 100%. Had his DNA. So if they had his DNA and
I don't know if he would have been arrested after 1986. And I don't know if forensic procedures, why wouldn't he have been arrested?
Yeah.
Because he, like, was out committing crimes in 86, 87, 88.
No, but I'm saying if he's the one that did the one in 85 where they had the DNA, if they didn't.
DNA was 86.
86?
Yeah.
Sorry, I thought you said 85. Same year
I was born.
So 86, well, it doesn't really change the point, though. Like, if they had his DNA in 86 and they didn't lose it, he's a known criminal. They would have.
I don't reckon they would have taken forensic procedures back then. I don't, like, 86 is, like, when it was given to cops. You got to remember, it's not like they were like, bingo, bango, here's DNA. It was like, right, it came out as you could use it, but it wasn't being rolled out fully.
What did he look like? Did he have fair hair? Was he balding on top? Did he have long hair? Like,
he does fit the description.
Right.
He does fit the description. Now, the source the source that I listened to, so that it was actually a podcast that I listened to, found an expert who got a hold of Lee's will, which confirmed he had lived with his de facto partner on Napoleon Street in Eltham. Now, it wasn't the street that Alfie took them down, but it was parallel to it and had a very similar streetscape.
And he was like, I think it's one of these. Like,
it was,
it's
25
one of these
years ago.
It's 10. You said early 2000s. It happened in 1990, didn't it?
No, but he's saying, like, the last time I went to Normie's house was 25 years ago.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
In the 70s.
Yeah.
Right. Jeez. Okay. Yeah. Jeez. Wow.
But he's
okay.
Like, he's always lived there. Like, I know he's always lived there.
Yeah. Okay.
So one issue with that, though, is that the house in Eltham was sold in 1989 in Christmas time. So Nicola could not have been attacked there if they had moved out.
Right. Okay.
So two suggestions are thrown out. Is one was that they remained in the house but leased it, or that he had other properties that side of Melbourne, which was other properties or businesses, which was a very common way to launder money.
Yeah.
So you'd – apparently what they do is you'd essentially buy the house – like, your cousin would get a loan and buy the house.
Hmm.
They'd buy the house with the bank's money, and then you would repay the mortgage with the stolen money, and therefore it's laundered into clean money because then you sell the house at the end. Bingo, bango.
Yeah, that's right. Or he just opens up a bakery and sells a shitload of Chico rolls.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is wild. This one's wild. So air traffic controllers and veteran pilots of major airlines were also spoken to. Now, they stated the Sydney to Melbourne route was the busiest, still is, and they would often pass over Eltham over a flight beacon they called Monty. Now, Monty was an old beacon that was about 10 nautical miles from Essendon Airport, which is the old airport.
Okay.
Now, we're going to get into some wind shit right now. If there's a northerly wind blowing, which is often, and they had to land on the northern runway, they would often try and turn west. So they're meant to come sort of straight in. But when the winds are northerly, it's kind of rough. So they'll normally turn west, turn off their like automatic pilot, go west until they could see Essendon Airport, fly over Essendon where they could visually see Tullamarine, and basically they're using visuals to land now, and it made it easier to land in the northerly winds.
Didn't you say that on the night, I don't know if it was Nicola or Sharon, but wasn't there a southerly wind that night?
I said anything about winds. There might have been.
You did mention winds, I thought. Right, okay.
Now, me being me, I needed to check if this is still the case. Now, so I checked. I went to Melbourne the other day to get a tattoo. It's this one. And there was a southerly blowing on that day. We landed the normal path.
Right.
On Saturday, however, there was a northerly blowing and the fucking path deviated to take that route. So there's like the normal, like you watch the flight track in and there's a dotted line where they're supposed to go and they go, they turn around, fly over Essendon Airport and then land. So the reason why is because that actually moves the area of focus to slightly down, so slightly more south from where they were looking, making Eltham an even more likely suburb for him to live.
Kind of like banging that triangle.
Exactly.
Because you did mention the winds because you were like, oh, it could carry, like if there's certain winds, that southerly. So that's where I was like, hang on, but now you're talking about a northerly, but that was obviously going on like an earlier theory.
Yeah.
Because they could hear the
planes landing.
Landing. So they've spoken to all these like experts, I imagine, in sort of recent years.
Yeah, it was 60 Minutes episode.
So everything's coming from the 60 Minutes episode.
They did very good. That's amazing. They got some very good experts out.
And So what I'm imagining, if you're watching on YouTube, you can see my hands. The normal one is you come over this way and then like let's just say there's a whole bunch of suburbs. This is the triangle. Mm. But if, for instance, there's a strong northerly, instead of just coming in normally like that, I could be wrong. Like, I'm not saying it's right. But, like, for argument's sake, you've got to come in like that. And so it sort of shifts. Yeah. Rather than being here, it shifts it.
Exactly.
Now, I could be doing that motion wrong, but the point still stands. Am I understanding that right?
Yes.
So they've just got to come in on a different angle to hit the tarmac, right?
And here's why the southerly wind might actually track.
Mentioned northerly wind, though.
No, so there was northerly wind.
Jesus Christ.
It's so confusing. I took so long to do this. So
this is fucking Newcastle and Wollongong all over again.
I know, it's so confusing. So another interesting fact is when he died in 92, he's de facto sold some properties.
There was an easterly wind.
No, sold some properties they owned in Kensington.
Yeah.
Which is sort of back up in that area.
Lower Plenty.
Yeah.
Ringwood.
Yeah. Now the new, and that would make sense for the sold property. So the new owners were organizing the place when they noticed a cupboard.
Yeah.
And as they're sort of packing their stuff, they notice that the cupboard had a false bottom.
Oh.
So they investigate and they're like, oh, this is exciting. Yeah. And there's a tunnel that leads out to the rear alleyway behind the home.
Oh, creepy.
What's
chills.
Even crazier?
Chills.
They find a bag in there with $15,000 cash in it.
Fuck yeah.
So this is obviously Lee's escape route and disappearing money if he was ever to get caught.
Shit.
Right?
Wild.
Here's my thing, right? I'm pretty sure when you buy a property, you buy everything that's on that property. So everything there belongs to you. So if you didn't report that, you're going to just keep the $15,000.
Yeah, like.
I'd keep it. I'd be like 100% process of crime, but I'm not reporting
this. No, of course we would.
Of course we would.
Of course.
We would.
I definitely didn't write, I would not be reporting that cash. Ha ha ha.
No, you wouldn't write that because that is the wrong thing to do.
We would because I would feel bad. And then exactly. I'd be like, oh, probably someone's and been you murdered know for this
you
money. Would,
exactly. You know that fucking.
I would secretly hope that we solved like some really big crime with it and then.
It's just, you've just always got to win out of something. You've always got to get something. You can never do anything like just like.
Imagine how cool that would be to come into a house, find a tunnel with a false bottom.
Oh, I know,
with 15,000
right?
And be shit. Told that it was like belonged to Normie Lee, who was one of the biggest bank robbers and yeah. possibly Mr. Krull.
Yeah. Well, you kind of lost me at that last bit. Mm.
So to this day.
So he seems like the number one.
It's 100% Normie Lee. It's 100%. Okay, no, I don't know that.
I was going to say, when are we going to.
I'm making shit up. I'm making shit. Okay. Based on what I have read, I think Normie Lee is the most viable suspect.
Yeah.
But, like, once again, how are you going to prove it now that he's passed and there's no DNA evidence and the likelihood he might not have DNA on the system?
Look, there is strong evidence, but like, how much of that evidence is on the say-so of Alfie Gay? I am not dismissing it. My first thought was when the crime stopped, he died. Like I just didn't see any other way. So that marries up. Mm. That, but other than that, like I don't know. It's sort of it. Whilst the trapdoor and everything else, like that's fun, but it's also well, yeah, we know that would be the case because he's a bank robber. Yeah. He would be know some dodgy, dangerous people. And that would make sense. And he didn't want to get caught by the cops. Mm. But otherwise, everything is sort of on the word of Alfie Gay, who he himself is not the most trustworthy. Now, in saying that, I tend to believe that he's sort of the prime suspect in it all.
And Ron Idles actually did believe him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it sort of comes down to what does he have to get out of it? I think that's the whole thing, right? Like, what does he stand to gain?
I think it was just one of those, like, I'm dying, I got to get this off my chest.
Yeah, exactly, like, exactly. That's like, what I mean. He's not going to get anything else.
Yeah, he's like, pedophilia, probably not cool with, and I think it's good to have an identity of the person.
I'm down with that. Look, and he did say that he had, like, the proclivities that he did. Particular school uniform and everything like that. And all the girls were, what, between 10 and 14 that we know of.
Mm.
So that's... Now, are we going to do a Normie Lee episode?
I so do. I so want to.
Because we do have the great boogie robbery.
We do. So we might like, I've been thinking about ways we could have little Patreon mini episodes and stuff like that where we can get into some fun details that we might not be able to otherwise. But
I definitely think, okay, so guys, we probably should have talked about this. Are we saying anything?
Can I finish my story first?
Absolutely fucking not. We're done.
Yeah, it's been an hour 20.
Sorry.
So obviously we don't know who he is. But back then, the 80s and 90s, police were not fully equipped to deal with child sexual offences. And you want to know something wild? Back then it was not illegal to have child abuse material. Wasn't illegal.
Is that just because it, like, please, this is just, please, my naivety, I'm hoping. Is that just because it was so uncommon?
No, that's when all the
I know I
pedophiles and the church stuff and all that there was no it would have been
church stuff is very different.
I reckon it would have been more rampant back then because there was no regulations.
Fuck.
Well,
yeah.
But that so there were a few good things that came from this task force. One is that became illegal.
Yeah. Well.
The second is that it forced change to the legislation. That allowed how close child sex offenders could get to schools.
Oh, good. That wasn't a thing, was it? This is all Mr. Krull.
This is all because of this case. And because obviously they investigated so many possible options, they looked at a lot of sex offenders and they ended up charging 75 people with a range of sexual offences from cold cases because of doing this.
Because they were just digging so hard into their backgrounds.
Yeah. So 75 cases got solved.
I am a bloody yo-yo this episode when it comes to the cops. One minute I'm like, what did you do? Why didn't you do that? And then the next minute sort of like, oh, yeah, boots on the ground. That's great.
Mm.
Fuck yeah, cops. Get it.
So that's fantastic.
That's so good.
And on April 12, 2016, when it comes to the Mr. Krull murders and especially the murder of Carmen Chan, the reward was increased from $100,000 to $1 million.
When was this, sorry?
Now $1 million, 2016. So there's now $1 million reward. Tips still coming to this day, but nothing's happened. But if you do, like, we like to tell these kind of stories because somebody knows something, it's now a distance away that maybe a lot of people have died and people feel like more comfortable speaking out. I was listening to actually to Crime Junkie and they're like, they get a lot of people come forward where there's sort of unspoken family secrets. Like everybody knew that person did that crime, but nobody speaks about it.
Yeah, that's right.
So you can call Crime Stoppers anonymously on 1-800-333-000. So if you are in that kind of case where you do know something or like any of this sounds familiar.
Yeah.
Or even if you're a previous victim and want to come forward now with more information.
Yeah.
But yeah, call Crime Stoppers 1-800-333-000 because it would be nice to find out who this guy is. And
it doesn't matter if he's been dead for 30 years.
Doesn't matter. Just, give a name. Know, give a name to the monster.
Yeah,
don't let
right.
him hide.
Carmen Chan's siblings are still alive, and you know,
and the victims are still alive,
Nicola,
and
Sharon,
living with that trauma.
Yeah, exactly right. So it would give them a little bit of closure.
Absolutely.
And I think that's the thing. It's like we are an itty bitty little podcast. But even amongst you guys, there are so many connections to the cases. Like we had last week, Daniel Kelso's like cousin
come forward
and message us and sort of give us some insights into it, which was, you know, it was, you know, we don't have permission to share.
It is a comment on our YouTube.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it's a public comment.
For some reason I was thinking it was a DM. But yeah, like that's on there and it's sort of like when we do Catherine McKnight, like, oh yeah, I grew up in that town kind of thing. You know, people we know or people that have commented. So it's, even though we are small, it's sort of like you guys
are a
brilliant community and everybody has a connection. And I think Australian True Crime, it is a big community, but also like if you found us, like you're kind of you're a little bit of a geek. You're a little bit of a nerd because, you know, we're not just your average sort of 20-minute here's a crime story kind of thing.
Yeah.
We go pretty hardcore, I'd say. And so that means like the chances of you knowing knowing someone that might know something is sort of increased as well. So it's definitely worth, even after all these years.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's wild. That's insane. But yeah, we'll definitely, I'm keen to do Norman Lee. Like, I don't know if there's enough to do him as a thing.
Enough to do him as a thing.
Still next week.
Yeah.
Have you started researching next week's episode?
I've almost finished next week's episode, maybe the week after next. Next week's episode.
You're getting so organized.
Next week's episode is graphic.
Oh, give us a hint. Give us a hint.
I got a lecture from these detectives. I think it was either at uni or for ANSFIS. But
Snowtown.
No, it's not Snowtown. I tell you if it was Snowtown. Snowtown would be like our 100th episode. But I was like, I was Googling.
Googling?
Do you want to know what I would always
what
Google?
What were you Googling?
Google.
Do you want to say that again?
Googling.
What were you Googling?
My Google search was an odd, very specific Google search.
Oh, you're definitely on a list now, aren't you?
Oh yeah, like when I was looking for it, I was like murder, blah 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 blah. And you'll see when we talk about it, because if I give away anything, it takes away. But like I was Googling it and I looked at that, and then I looked at our spreadsheet, did some research, and I was like, oh my god, this is the one, because I saw a walkthrough of the crime scene. The offender does a walkthrough of the crime scene with police.
Salt and pepper. It's not salt. Doesn't have anything to do with salt.
No.
Trying to guess.
I know what you're thinking of. No, I don't think you will be a super familiar name. You might be.
Oh, okay. Well, if it's on the spreadsheet, I wouldn't know about it.
Yeah, you do know about it then. It's on the spreadsheet. It's a good one.
I probably put it there.
You definitely put it there.
Anyway.
There's 100 on there. Can you remember every single one?
No.
Yeah, there you go.
But that's why I need a clue. So there's a murder.
You know,
all right, everybody. Actually, do you know what? Jeanette will get it. Jeanette will get it.
Jeanette should be like, hey, guys, it's this.
Yeah.
Like, come on, Jeanette. I just Googled it.
I Googled murder. Jeanette's like, I know that. I know that case.
I know that guy.
I know that guy. Okay. Well, I will definitely do that. And then maybe the next episode after that, we'll do Norman Lee.
Yeah, because I think next episode is very graphic.
Okay.
So it might be nice to have a robbery.
Yeah, I was going to say.
You know what I mean? Like a robbery where the only victim is like a bank.
A bank, yeah. Yeah. That's right. And then now we are, I know we talk about it and it's at the end of the episode. So we said we wouldn't do our big intros. I know we kind of talked about that.
You can leave now.
You can leave now. If you don't want to talk to us, you don't want to listen, then okay, fine. Whatever.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. But yeah, we're just going to ramble for another couple of minutes, but I know we've talked about plans at the moment. We have plans for Signal 2. Part of that is sort of to, I think we've spoken about it before, like have a business with it basically, just so we can sell merch and we can do that. And once we have all that up and running, we are we're probably going to look at doing like Patreon mini episodes, that kind of thing. We just, but yeah. So the reason I'm letting you guys know is just so there's, you know what we're going on, what's going through our heads, but also we love ideas because, you know, we have I said, you know, enough times? I don't know. You know?
Yeah. I just was sassy for no reason then. I didn't even noticed. I didn't even noticed. And I just was a little sass pot because I could. And I've been talking for an hour and a half.
You're killing me. It's a black dog. Yeah. So, but also to give us ideas. So we talked about now that Jeanette can guess anything for.
Is this going to be our thing now?
Yeah, Jeanette, you're now part of the Signal 2 lore, okay? You're the Oracle. We shall now refer to you henceforth
as the Oracle.
But yeah, so if we want to do a little more competitions because that was fun while it lasted. We will do the mini Patreon episodes. We're going to continue to do our shit chats. And then obviously this. So nothing is going to change.
We'll be like little busy bees.
That's right.
It's me being a busy
and
bee.
And I've got a few more weeks and then I can come in and help.
You
and
can do more episodes.
I can do more episodes, which I'm excited about. Yeah. Just because I feel like with me, I don't know, I haven't done the Indigenous focus, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander focus ones that I would like to do. So, yeah, I'm excited to kind of put a little bit more focus into those because I've got a few that are sort of like half research that I know about, but I just, you know, not well enough to actually do an episode. So just, yeah, get into that. So basically, long story short, big things ahead for Signal 2 podcast.
Just making good content good for content. You lovely human beings.
That's right. So we love yous all. We hope you have a great week.
Yeah.
Like us on... I don't know. What the fuck? What are we? Like us on Instagram. Follow us on Instagram. Subscribe to us on YouTube. Join our Facebook group.
Facebook community.
Like just do all the huge sub. Fuck.
What am just I tell to, everyone.
Social media. That's the word I'm looking for.
My just goal is to one day have enough followers that we can do like a live episode and we can all get together and have a glass of wine all together and we can talk about stuff and we can like a semi-interactive kind of thing where we can, you guys can ask us questions or if we're like, what's the fucking word for this? We had one person come forward and comment and be like, hey, Jimmy, I knew that creepy interview you were talking about. And
Stephen
like,
you could
shout that out at us. We'd be like,
yeah, you know. That's right. Well, look, we could probably do it now. There are rooms at seat 10, so that'll be fine. but yeah, no, all good. So yeah, that is actually on the cards for potentially later this year, beginning of next year. But yeah, we'll see. It would be good. Anyway, we hope you guys take care. Thank you for listening. We love you. We will be back on Friday for a shit chat and then next Wednesday for another true crime episode. We hope you take care of each other. Take care of yourself.
Just be not a dick.
You're so tired and hot and everything, aren't you? You're just like, Alice is just like, I'm done. Don't be a dick, all right?
My knee ditch is sweating.
Your glasses are fogging up as well.
I know. It's, yeah.
Anyway, we love you. Don't be a dick.
Yeah. Sweaty whoop whoop.
Whoop whoop, everybody. Love yous all.
Love you.